you turn, please, in the Old Testament to Genesis chapter 11. And we'll read the first 9 verses. Genesis 11, the first 9 verses. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city, and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. And then from the New Testament, we're going to read from Mark chapter 7. And we're going to read from verse 31 to the end of the chapter. Mark chapter 7, verse 31 to the end of the chapter. "Again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. Then they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him. And he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers in his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then, looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, 'Ephphatha,' that is, 'be opened.' Immediately his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plainly. Then he commanded them that they should tell no one. But the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, 'He has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak.'" This is the first Lord's Day that falls on Easter that I have not been in my home congregation preaching. And for 30 years in my home congregation, on this day, we began like this, but only on this one day of the year. Christos Anesti. Now that's Greek, and I'm going to teach it to you this morning. Christos Anesti is Christ is risen. That was our call to worship this morning. And Alithos Anesti is verily he is risen, or he is risen indeed, or truly he is risen. Only to me it sounds wonderful in Greek. So I'm going to say Christ is risen in Greek, Christos Anesti, and you are all going to answer me Alithos Anesti, and we'll do it until we get it right. Christos Anesti. Oh, you're quick learners, but I like that. We'll do it anyway. Christos Anesti. When we lived in Cyprus, all through Larnaca, Easter morning, everyone greeted each other the same way on Easter morning. In the homes, walking along the streets, in the churches, Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. That means death is conquered. That means sin is defeated. That means Satan has lost. You know, the Gospel of Mark begins with the statement of its theme. I don't know whether you can quote Mark chapter 1, verse 1. Yesterday we had a question. Where would you go in the Bible to find a place that talks about Christ's divinity? And all good Protestants will say John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But I want to suggest Mark 1:1. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That puts it out there very plainly, doesn't it? The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now that word Christ, for all the first readers, meant the Son of David. So he's human, he's the Son of David, and he's the Son of God. There is our belief about Jesus Christ. And if you go through the Gospel of Mark, that first chapter, after a couple of verses of introduction about John the Baptist, just describe what Jesus has done for us. He has defeated Satan. The first story is about a time of Jesus preaching in Capernaum, and a demon tries to interrupt his sermon, and he says, "You be quiet," and you come out. And the demon does that, and they're amazed because he has an authority they have never seen before. And then he goes over to Peter's mother-in-law's house, and she's sick with a fever. And he says to her, "Get up." She gets up, healthy enough instantly to serve them. And that fever, of course, points to the fact that we end up sick and dying. He has power over death. And then the next thing is he meets a leper. And leprosy separates you from the presence of God and to worship at the temple, according to the Jewish law. And the leper, he touches him. He touches him. According to the law, that would make Jesus unclean. Only Jesus has such power that the leper doesn't make Jesus unclean. He makes the leper clean. He separates, he solves the fact that we're separated from God by our sin. And that's the point of that miracle. Right the way we see, he has power over Satan. If he didn't, we are not saved. He has power over death. If there is no resurrection, we are fools. We might as well give it up. And he has power over sin. He reconciles us to God. Now, we've been studying in our adult Sunday school class the book of Hebrews, which starts off in the first two chapters talking about who Jesus is. He is, first of all, the Son of God. And then in chapter 2, but he is of the seed of David, made like unto us of flesh and blood. And then at a certain point in chapter 2, the writer says, but we don't see all things put under his feet. What do we see? But we do see Jesus. And here we have the dilemma of our Christian life as we live it in this age. Jesus has defeated our great three enemies, sin, Satan, and death itself. But we don't always feel victorious. I was thinking this morning of the city of Paris in the fall of 1944. I don't know whether you can picture what I'm talking about when I say the city of Paris in the fall of 1944. It's a city liberated by the Allies. D-Day has come and gone, the German armies have been pushed back, and Paris is liberated. And now what does Paris look like that it's set free? It looks awful. It looks awful. It has bomb craters every place. Buildings destroyed. People dead and rotting in the streets. It has houses gone. It has communication systems down. It may even have this distant sound of gunfire as the battle goes on to the east and to the south. And yet from Paris goes out the message to every last town and village in France. Paris is liberated, which means we too soon. the good news of salvation. Now, what do you do if you're in Paris in 1944 and you've just been set free? I hope, and I know this is what they did, you get to work. You get to work cleaning up the rubble in the streets, filling in the craters, fixing your houses. There's no point in doing it if the Germans are still in charge. Just come and blow stuff up again. But once you're set free, there's a reason for hard work. There's a reason for hope. There's a reason for planning. There's a reason to move ahead. And that's what our calling is as Christians, is to rebuild a life, an existence, which has been so damaged by our enemy's sin. Is it worth the building? Yes. Why? Because your great enemy is defeated. Because your great enemy, death, is defeated. And because you are put right with God, He gives you the power to build. Now, what is the standard theological term for what I'm talking about? This is sanctification. This is sanctification. And Paul in his letters tells us that we need to work on our sanctification. That sanctification is part of our salvation. Salvation is bigger than our justification. Salvation includes everything that Christ has done, is doing, and will do in us all the way to our resurrection and our glorification. And we are to work at our sanctification. So Paul says in Philippians, therefore, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to do His good pleasure. Now, all of this is a long introduction to what I'm going to talk about this morning, which is rebuilding within marriages. It has a broader application to rebuilding in friendships or any connections we have with people. But I'm going to focus on marriage for several reasons. First, in our society, marriages are not as a whole doing well. I don't even need to cite statistics or give stories. You know this. But happy marriages make a happy church. And sound marriages make a good city. And our well-being, your well-being in this church, in fact, depends not just on how well you're doing. It depends on how well everybody else is doing. And if in this church everybody else's marriage is a source of conflict and strife, you will feel it. That is not just a private issue in their family. It will spill out. I just finished pre-marriage counseling. By the way, for all of you who may sometime go into the pastorate, pre-marriage counseling is one of the most fun things you can ever do. I love pre-marriage counseling. Post-marriage counseling is something else, but we'll leave that aside. So with this couple, who were pretty mature in the faith, I did something I'd never done before. I said, all right, it's your job to draw up a syllabus of what we'll talk about. And then I sent them away. So they had to talk together and say, what should we talk about in pre-marriage counseling? And they came back to me with a syllabus. And the syllabus included communication between husband and wife in marriage. I said, okay, and that's the source of this morning's sermon. We're not going to be talking about everything related to marriage. We're not going to talk about adultery, divorce. Those are two huge threats to marriage, obviously. What I want to talk about is barriers to communication so that husband and wife live with constant misunderstanding and little squabbles. If I were to ask all the husbands and wives here, do your marriages have within them these sort of little squabbles and misunderstandings that make life sort of not so much fun some of the time? Don't put your hands up. Because the rest of you who didn't put your hands up, I'd probably accuse of... Anyway. One of the effects of sin is to make communication difficult between us and God and between us and other people, even within marriage. So when I got this assignment, I'd asked for it, pre-marriage counseling on communication issues in marriage, I said to myself, okay, what are the biggest barriers to communication? If we had time, I'd set this question to all of you. What do you think are the biggest barriers to communication between people, and specifically between husband and wife? I'm going to pick four big barriers. I'm going to argue that these are the biggest barriers. So then you can tell me after the sermon that I missed one and that I got it wrong. What are the biggest barriers between husband and wife for communication? Well, here's my four, and we're going to talk about each one. Barrier one, you speak different languages. Barrier two, one of you is deaf. Barrier three, one of you can't talk. Barrier four, you never bother to talk. I want to talk about different languages. There is a wonderful scene at the end of Shakespeare's play, Henry V. And I love the scene in Laurence Olivier's version, and I love it even more in, Brana's version, yes. All right. So the war is over. The English have won. This war turned out good. The English have won. And so now Henry is going to marry Kate, I believe. And so in anticipation of marrying the English king, Kate now begins to work with her maid and learn English. It's a very funny scene as they go through various words. You've got to learn the language of your husband. He, of course, as he woos her, is quite aware he can't speak French. And every now and then, as I recall, there are a couple of feeble efforts that he tries to throw a French phrase or into the wooing, and it's meant for humor, but you recognize the communication difficulties. Now, this fact that we have language differences goes, as we read, all the way back to the Tower of Babel, but it continues. One of the difficulties for us with languages is they constantly change. And I'll guess that any congregation that had Christian Hegemian as a pastor for some years was well aware of the subtleties and the little eddies and currents and sometimes rip currents that language has to lead you astray. You know, it's always amused me that you've got clear echoes of this right here in the Bible, of changing language. Even if you speak the same language, it changes on you. You see, Babel keeps happening all the time, but language keeps changing on you. Here's 1 Samuel 9, verse 9. This is when Saul is going to go look for somebody to help him find the donkeys. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, "Come, let us go to the seer. For he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer." So there, whenever 1 Samuel is written, he's using the old way the story was told before he wrote it down. And Saul goes to see the seer, but he's got to explain to his readers, whenever it was that he writes it, that now we call this person a prophet. I ran into a story that I heard quite a while ago that amused me on this score. This was a young man from one of the English-speaking places in the world, but not North America. And he was visiting for a summer in Canada someplace and staying at somebody's house while he was there for the summer. And he really grew fond of the young woman in the house and finally got up his nerve to say something to her. And nobody had made him feel more at ease and at home than this young woman. And so he finally got his nerve and looked at her and said, "You are the most homely girl I have ever known." When I was learning Greek, and we were in Cyprus, got to the point where I got far enough into the language that I would sometimes dream in Greek. And then when I would speak in Greek, I would take on the gestures, which are much more animated than in English, and take on the volume, which is much louder than in English. And I remember one day, as we'd had some friends over, and I'd been speaking animatedly, and they left, and I switched back into English, my wife says to me, "You're in English now." When we were first married, we had a little incident that went this way. I had done something worthy of reprimand. I don't remember what, but let's pick something that sometimes husbands do. I took off my t-shirt and just tossed it on the floor, thereby drawing a reprimand from my wife, firmly stated. I said to her, "Don't yell at me." She said, "I'm not yelling. If you want to hear yelling..." And then we had quite a discussion about, was she or wasn't she yelling at me? Now, what was underneath this really silly argument? What was underneath it was, in her family, yelling was used in its literal sense. Loud voice. In my family, the word yell was used in a metaphorical sense, to speak firmly to somebody. And so I had used it in a metaphorical sense, and she had used or heard it in a literal sense. So in my metaphorical sense, she was yelling at me, and in her literal sense, she was doing no such thing. Thank you. Of such things are marital spats made. And one of our callings as Christians, as we rebuild in the ruins wrought by sin, and different languages is one of the consequences of sin. We may find delight in it sometimes, but that lack of communication is not in the world's... It does not make for peace. So in our marriages, we need to work at actually learning the language of the other person. And even if it's English, it may well be that there are different usages of words. We have found this as parents as we've gotten older, that our children come home with words that they use that somewhat shock us. But then our children say, "But that's not what the word means." And we say, "Oh, yes, it is what it means." And they say, "No, that's not what it means anymore." Maybe some of you are middle-aged parents who've had this discussion with certain words with your children. Now, the naive, or perhaps I should say the self-centered, when there are language difficulties, usually just blame the other person. So there's the stereotype of the American who says something to the foreigner and the foreigner doesn't get it, and what does the American do? He yells. He says it louder. Now, that's not just an American fault. I have a vivid memory of a stadium where I used to go and run in Larnaca, and the right to sell food at the stadium was given to this old widow who was illiterate, and but that was her position. So we became friends as I go over there and buy food and drink from her. And so she asked me one day, all in Greek. She knew not a word of English, and she couldn't read. So she asked me in Greek, "Postina ta zizania sou," which means, "How are your weeds?" And I looked at her, and I said, "What did you say?" Well, what she had said was perfectly plain, and the problem was I didn't understand it. So she just yelled at me. I thought to myself, she'd be very American here. She said, "Postina ta zizania sou." "How are your weeds?" I still didn't get it. I said, "What did you say?" Then, really exasperated, she says to me, "Postina ta zizania sou." And then it clicked. She meant my children. I said, "Oh, my weed's fine." How do you get beyond the self-centeredness that assumes language communication problems are always the other person to a place where you realize that the communication problem is sometimes the result of the different languages, which really goes back to the effect of sin on the whole world. God confuses the language to make it hard for us to get along. Did you catch that in Babel? That's really the point. God confuses the language so that we can't get along and cooperate. And the gospel in the rebuilding is we learn to speak the same language so we can cooperate and get along. How? Well, there's a wonderful verse in James, which I will quote over and over again. It's James chapter 1, verse 19. Do you know which one I'm going to read? So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Did I get it? I was dealing with a couple I know that had a hard time listening to each other. This is post-marriage counseling. Had a hard time listening to each other, hard time understanding each other. And one would get talking and just not want to be interrupted in a long speech. And the other one then, when they finally got the floor, would want to do a long speech. And what I saw there was slow to hear, swift to speak, swift to wrath. And that is not the way to learn each other's languages. All right, here's the second communication problem in marriage. One or both of you are deaf. This happens literally, especially with older couples. Maybe you've heard one or the other. One of them says something, the other one says, "Hey, what'd you say? Will you stop mumbling?" Now, there's a solution to that problem that is less than perfect, but if you get a hearing aid, it helps. But you know, there are ways in which people are voluntarily deaf with each other. People are voluntarily deaf to God. You know how that is? You just refuse to read the Bible. That's you making yourself just deaf. You can't hear anything because you're just not reading. You won't go to church because you don't want to hear God's word preached. You're just deaf. Our country is full of deaf people who act like they're deaf where God is concerned. They don't want to hear. And people are sometimes voluntarily deaf to each other. And we have phrases for that. You tune somebody out. You turn a deaf ear. My students, I taught high school for a number of years, students would work very hard to acquire a facial expression that says, "I'm paying close attention to you," while in fact they were miles away. And the more experienced a teacher got, the more able we were to look at somebody and say, "You're not listening to a word I say." And most students would admit that was true if you caught them on it. And with guys, it was always very easy to know where they were. They were either thinking about sports or girls. I mean, it was simple. So you say, "Are you thinking about sports or a girl?" And if it was sports, they'd say sports. If it was girl, they'd say, girls are more complicated as to where they were. It could be sports or a boy, or "she said, I said, but I didn't say what I really said was," right? That sort of thing. By the way, girls, guys don't do that. Actually, I had some girls admit they were thinking about their nails. Guys don't do that either. So girls are a lot more complicated to think where they've gone. But they both boys and girls, they just turn a deaf ear to you because they're off on something else. Men, have you ever had your wife say to you, "You don't listen"? If she says that to you, I'm going to make a general statement here. If she says you don't listen, the reason she says that is you don't listen. Now, sometimes a quick student will just have enough attention to be able to say, "Oh, yes, I was, you just said." But they weren't. And sometimes a quick husband will be able to say, oh yes, I was. I can tell you exactly what you just said. Nevertheless, if the wife says you weren't listening, she's probably right. Even if you can quote back the last sentence, you actually were paying no mind, really. Well, when you turn deaf, communication stops, doesn't it? One person is saying something, the other person is not receiving. How do you rebuild that? Well, I'm going to suggest that if you find that you're somebody who's not listening, especially in your marriage, you need to ask God for ears. Ask God for ears with which to learn to listen and then practice using them. Jesus said at the end of a lot of his parables, you remember the sort of little phrase he'd have? I always thought it was weird when I was a kid. Now I understand. He'd end up and he'd say at the end of a story, and if you have ears, go ahead and listen. He who has ears, let him hear. As a little kid, I say, well, that's odd. They all had ears. Jesus heals the deaf. We read that. He does all things well. When John the Baptist sent some people, and John was in prison, he sent some of his disciples to Jesus. Are you the one we're actually waiting for? Jesus said, you go back and tell John what you've seen. The blind see. The lame walk. The deaf hear. And the poor have the gospel preached to them. You go back with that message. If Jesus Christ is working in your life, husband, wife, one of the things that he is doing or intends to do or wants to do, especially in your marriage, is to teach you how to listen, how to use your ears, how to hear, really, the person that is supposed to be closest to you of all people on earth. What can get closer than this, that you leave your father and mother for this person? What can get closer than this, that you become one flesh? What can be closer than husband and wife meant to represent in the world as living illustrations Christ and the church? What could be closer than husband and wife in God's plan, where we promise to be loyal to each other even until death parts us? And we promise to be loyal whether it works out well or badly, in sickness and in health, for richer or for poorer, for better or for worse. That's what we've promised. We don't make those promises to anybody else. Shouldn't you listen and learn how to hear the person who's your husband or wife? That was the third problem for communication. The first is you speak different languages. You need to learn the same language. Second is you don't have ears. You're deaf. Third is you don't talk. You're not wanting to have something to say, but you don't say it. Something on your mind, but you don't say it. Or being unable to say it is really frustrating. There's a picture of that actually in Luke's Gospel. A man named Zechariah was working in the temple, and the angel Gabriel appeared to him and said, you and Elizabeth will have a son, and he will be the forerunner of the Most High. And Zechariah, who's an old man, and his wife, and they've not had no children, they're just right at the end of, or maybe past normal childbearing age, Zechariah is doubtful. And the angel says, well, here's the sign that I'm telling you the truth. You won't be able to talk again until the child is born. So when Zechariah came out of the temple, he couldn't talk. But he made sign language to indicate he'd seen an angel. And people wanted to know. So he had to get call for a tablet and write. Fortunately, he was literate. The child was born. What's his name? John. He had to write it. His name is John. And then his tongue was loosed and he praised God. Anybody raising children will see this in a toddler. You know, toddlers age 1 to 2 can understand a huge amount. They understand. They all understand better than we give them credit for. And then they take advantage of that. All right, they understand. By the time your kid's 1 and a half, original sin is already vindicated as a truth. But when a toddler wants to tell something to his parents and he doesn't know, he can't say it yet. Huge frustration. Huge frustration. Husbands and wives, don't be voluntarily mute in your marriage. Let's pick an example and pin it on the wife. A sentence that begins this way. If you really loved me, you would have noticed. And whatever it is. You would have noticed that I need a hug. You would have noticed I need flowers. You would have noticed I need whatever. Now, what is the husband's defense to that sentence? I am not a mind reader. That is the husband's defense. Now, I've just been reading a book that says it's not a very good defense. Husbands should learn to read their wives' body language and so on. But I still think it's a good defense. Husbands are not mind readers. If the wife chooses not to say what is on her mind, then the husband is only half guilty for not knowing what's on her mind. Sure, he should pick up some nonverbal clues, but that's why we have tongues, to use them, say what's on our minds. Husband, I read in the Philadelphia Inquirer the advice column every now and then, and the letter from somebody, and then the advice. Right? And the letter was from somebody saying, I can't get my wife's attention. So my way of getting her attention is to just not talk to her for 2 days. What do you think of this method? Silent treatment. That's another kind of voluntary, I won't talk. Where and I'm going to pin this on the husband, you get mad at your wife, and so you just stop talking. And maybe you walk out of the room while you stop talking. Maybe you walk out of the house while you stop talking. Maybe you walk out of the house, get in the car, and go for a ride while you stop talking. But you just stop talking. Now, that leaves the wife feeling rejected and shunned in her own house. And men, you're acting like your tongue's been torn out. That gets in the way of communication, doesn't it? When you just refuse to talk. Well, how do you deal with this problem? Well, again, the first thing is to repent of this refusal and failure to communicate with the person who should be your best friend. It's our job with our husbands and wives to choose to talk, to say what's on our mind, to not use the silent treatment. Now, suppose the person you're married to is mute a lot of the time. Well, I'd say work hard to listen and wait patiently until they're ready to talk and then really listen. Fourth barrier to communication. And this applies to friends and parents and children. It's not just husbands and wives, but I'm focusing on husbands and wives this morning. Fourth barrier to communication. And that is, other things are always more important than communication. So that you are so busy with other things that there is no time and opportunity to communicate. There's an example of this actually from the life of Jesus again. He was visiting at the home of his good friends in Bethany, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. And his disciples were there and he was teaching. And Martha is running around preparing a good meal for them. And at some point she comes in very frustrated and she says to Jesus, "Jesus, would you tell my lazy, no good bum of a sister to please get up and help me fix all the food?" I know there are a lot of Christians who read that story and sympathize automatically with Martha. And Jesus says, "Ah, Martha, Martha, you're running around taking care of a lot of good things, but Mary's chosen the best thing." But Mary's just sitting there listening to it. Mary's chosen the good part. See, Martha is so busy being hostess, she doesn't have time to listen to Jesus. So she's not hearing what he has to teach. The implication is everybody would be better off. Martha would be better off if she just joined Mary and sat there and listened to Jesus. And when they were done, somebody might bring 5 loaves and 2 fish and we'd be taken care of.
Modern life, I don't think it's all that different from earlier life, actually. We like to pretend to ourselves our problems are harder than the grandparents. You've all thought that. Oh, my grandparents had it easier, but it's not true. I won't go into why it's not true, but it's not true. But anyway, we think it's really hard to find time to communicate sometimes. There are modern methods of communication that are wonderful. You can use your thumbs. When I go away, I don't like using my thumbs, but when I go away, I like to call home, and it's easy now. I think it is wise for husbands and wives to deliberately plan their lives that they will have regular times to talk together, not by cell phone and not by texting, actual talking together. We have some friends in the church who had a system of one night a week date night. So one night a week, they would always husband and wife go out on a date. That was the schedule. It was as regular in their schedule as the Lord's Day was. I think that's one of the reasons we are giving the Lord's Day as a day of rest. If you've been so busy during the week, time for husband and wife to talk to each other. Lots of time. What my wife and I have done from the time we were married is both of us go to bed at the same time every night. So we go to bed at the same time, and then we have time to talk before we drop off to sleep. No going to bed, the other one sneak in an hour and a half later. When the man in the beginning was alone, God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I'll make him a suitable helper." And he brought him a woman. And he looked at her and he said, "She's like me, flesh of my flesh, bone of my bones." And he said, and the scriptures comment, "So for this, you leave your father and mother and you cleave to your wife." I read a while back, every man should have a best friend. And the book meant every man should have another man as a best friend. And I basically stopped reading at that point. I said, if you're married, God's already given you your best friend. At least that's how it should be in marriage. Jesus said to his disciples, this is John chapter 15, verse 15. "No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known to you." I have called you friends. Marriage includes friendship, and friends talk. Marriage represents Christ in the church, so it is an important place. I would say it's the most important place. It's pretty close to the most important place for rebuilding to begin taking place. We're set free from Satan. We're set free from the power of sin. We are set free from the fear of death. And it is so wrong when a husband or wife plays deaf or pretends they can't talk or when a couple just doesn't have time to communicate. Or when you stubbornly maintain your own separate languages and then quarrel over the meanings of words. Let me try a thought experiment. Imagine a visitor to this congregation who comes and visits for 6 weeks in a row, and you are wonderfully hospitable, so that once on each Lord's Day and once during the week, this person is invited into a different family in this church. So that at the end of 6 weeks, they've been in 12 different families in this church. And then just imagine this person going off and telling his friends something like the following. "I've been visiting this church, and I want to tell you the most astonishing thing about that church. In every family, husband and wife seem like they're the best friends of each other. In every family, they understand each other without difficulty. In every family, there seems to be open and free communication between husband and wife. In every family, not only is there not the undercurrents where you say, oh, this marriage is going to end soon. In every family, you say, I can't imagine the one without the other. In every family, it looks as though they are not just, and he probably wouldn't use this language, but in every family, it looks as though there's been been something of a mind meld, to use the Star Trek approach. They become so much one flesh that there is a mind meld. You know, I can imagine that some people stuck in those quarreling, low-level conflict marriages that are so common in our country, they would say, you know, I need to visit that place too. We're called to be light. We're called to be salt in this world. Bad marriages have a ripple effect out over the whole society. Good marriages have a ripple effect of healing, rebuilding, and sanctification throughout the church and throughout the society. It would be like going through war-torn Paris 3 months after liberation and coming upon a block where all the houses were now already rebuilt. And the streets were clean. And the flowers were blooming. And the lawns were neat. And there was no sign left of the war. And you'd say, how did this get here? And the answer is, the people in this block really got to work rebuilding. And they didn't just sit around on their hands. If you'd like the world to see the victory that Christ has won in your life and your family, this is one place to work at. Husband and wife living together in the reality that death is defeated, sin is overcome, and Satan is no longer having any power over us. Where we communicate freely, communicate often, and communicate in love and patience. Where everyone is swift to hear, slow to speak, and therefore, you notice what comes last, slow to wrath. Godly marriages, Christian friendships are possible because Christ is risen, and he is risen indeed.